hat, cafe, coffee, cool, cup, cigarette. He was very good at filling in letters and incomplete words. And yet, at 16, he was still unable, despite repeated demonstrations, to judge the constancy of volume, despite differing heights in different vessels, a concept that, as Piaget showed, most children grasp at 7. The train passed through tiny villages of wooden houses and painted churches, giving me the sense of a Tolstoyan world, unchanged in 100 years. As Stephen watched all this intently, I thought of the thousands of images he must be registering, constructing, all of which he could convey in vivid pictures and vignettes, but none of them, I suspected, synthesized into any general impression in his mind. I had the feeling that the whole visible world flowed through Stephen like a river, without making sense, without being appropriated, without becoming part of him in the least. That though he might retain everything he saw, in a sense, it was retained as something external, unintegrated, never built on, connected, revised, never influencing or influenced by anything else. I thought of his perception, his memory, as quasi-mechanical, like a vast store or library or archive, not even indexed or categorized or held together by association, yet where anything might be accessed in an instant, as in the random access memory of a computer. I found myself thinking of him as a sort of train himself, a perceptual missile traveling through life, noting, recording, but never appropriating, a sort of transmitter of all that rushed past, but himself unchanged, unfed by the experience. As we approached Leningrad, Stephen decided it was time to draw. "Pencil, Margaret, darling," he said. I was amused by the darling, a Margaretism that he had adopted, and I could not decide whether it was automatic or more conscious, a humorous parody. The train was very jolty, and I was able to make only brief notes. But Stephen was perfectly able to draw, with his usual speed and fluency. I had been amazed by this earlier, on the airplane. He looked clumsy, but he picked up some motor skills, it seemed, almost instantly, as some autistic people seem to do. In Amsterdam, he had had no hesitation in walking a narrow gangway to a houseboat, something he had never done before. And this reminded me of another autistic youngster I had met, who suddenly walked a tightrope, expertly and fearlessly, the day after seeing it done at the circus. Finally, after 11 hours of slow traveling, rural Russia slowly unrolling before us, we arrived at a grand station in Leningrad, a station of faded pre-revolutionary czarist splendor. The whole panorama of the city, with its fine low 18th-century buildings, its sense of European cosmopolitan civilization, could be seen from our hotel windows, glittering in the northern white night. Stephen was eager to see it in full daylight, and decided he would draw it the next morning, first thing. I was not in the room when he started, but Margaret told me later that he made an interesting false start. There was a famous old cruiser, the Aurora, moored in the Neva, and Stephen had drawn it way out of proportion to the buildings on the other side. When he realized what he had done, he said, "I'll just start again. It's no good. It won't work." He tore off another sheet of paper and started again. The flagrant incongruity, initially between boat and building, made me think of other smaller incongruities in his work. The fact that he might use multiple perspectives in his drawings, and that these did not always precisely coincide. Later that day, we went to the Alexander Nevsky Monastery and found ourselves unexpectedly in the middle of a Russian Orthodox wedding. The choir consisted of a gaunt, ragged huddle led by a blind woman with blazing blue eyes. But their voices were marvelous, almost beyond bearing, especially that of the basso profundo, who looked, Margaret and I felt, like an escapee from the gulag. Margaret thought that Stephen was unaffected by their voices, but I felt the opposite, that he was profoundly affected. A measure of how difficult it was at times to know what he was feeling. The climax of our time in Leningrad was a visit to the Hermitage, but Stephen showed a somewhat childish reaction to the incredible paintings there. "See how it's built up in blocks," Margaret said of one Picasso, a woman with a tilted head. Stephen merely asked, "Has she got a pain?" Margaret told Stephen to take special note of the Matisse dance, and Stephen gazed at it, without much sign of interest, for a full 30 seconds. Back in London, Margaret suggested he draw it, and he did, unhesitatingly, brilliantly. It was only later that a curious conflation was noted, again by the observant Mr. Williamson. Stephen had used the forms of the dancers in the Hermitage painting, but had given them the colors of another version of the painting, which hangs in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. His sister Annette, it turned out, had given him a poster of the MoMA dance years before, and now he gave the American colors to the Russian picture. One might wonder whether this was a lapse of memory or a confusion, but Stephen, I suspect, was being playful and decided to give the Hermitage picture the MoMA colors, as he decided to give the History Museum onion domes, or, for that matter, my house a chimney, or in another drawing, the Rockefeller Center Prometheus, a penis. Weary from a day of touring and drawing, we left the Hermitage and headed back to our hotel for tea. Seeing that Stephen needed some diversion, Margaret said to him, "You be the teacher now. You, Oliver, the pupil." A glint appeared in Stephen's eye. "What is 2 takeaway 1? He asked. 1, I said promptly. "Good. Now 20 minus 10. I pretended to think for a bit, then said 10. "That's very good," Stephen said. "Now 60 minus 10. I cogitated hard, screwed up my face. 40, I said. "No," said Stephen. "Wrong. Think." I tried to help myself by holding up my fingers in multiples of 10. "I've got it. 50. "Right," said Stephen, with an approving smile. "Very good. Now, 40 minus 20. That was really difficult. I thought for a full minute. 10? "No," said Stephen. "You must concentrate." "But you did pretty well," he added kindly. The episode was a stunning imitation of an arithmetic lesson such as one might give to a retarded child. Stephen's voice, his gestures, mimicked to perfection those of a well-meaning but condescending teacher. Specifically, I felt with some discomfort, mine when I had tested him in London. He had not forgotten this. It was a lesson to me, to all of us, never to underestimate him. Stephen delighted in reversing roles, just as in his cartoon of himself fanning me. The Russia trip was in some ways delightful, exciting, in others saddening, disappointing, disillusioning. I had hoped to get behind Stephen's autism, to see the person underneath, the mind. But there had been only the merest intimation of this. I had hoped, perhaps sentimentally, for some depth of feeling from him. My heart had leapt at the first "Hello, Oliver," but there had been no follow-up. I wanted to be liked by Stephen, or at least seen as a distinct person. But there was something, not unfriendly, but de-differentiating in his attitude, even his indifferent, automatic good manners and good humor. I had wanted some interaction. Instead, I got a slight sense, perhaps, of how parents of autistic children must feel when they find themselves faced with a virtually unresponsive child. I had still, in some sense, been expecting a relatively normal person, with certain gifts and certain problems. Now I had the sense of a radically different, almost alien mode of mind and being, proceeding in its own way, not to be defined by any of my own norms. Yet there were times, the egg cracking, the pupil and teacher game together, when I felt a current between us. So I still hoped for some sort of relationship with him, and made a point of visiting him each time I went to London, generally a few times a year. On one or two occasions I was able simply to go for a walk with Stephen. I hoped, still, that he might unwind, show me something of his spontaneous real self. But though he would always greet me with his cheery, "Hello, Oliver," he remained as courteous, as grave, as remote as ever. There was, however, one enthusiasm we shared, a fondness for car spotting. Stephen especially liked the grand convertibles of the 1950s and 1960s. My favorite cars, by contrast, were the sports cars of my youth. Bristol's, Fraser Nash's, old Jag's, Aston Martin's. Between us, we could identify most of the cars on the road, and Stephen, I think, came to see me as an ally or comrade in the game of car spotting. But this was as close as we ever got. Floating Cities was published in February of 1991 and quickly went to the top of the bestseller list in England. Stephen was told this and said, "Very nice." He seemed unaffected or uncomprehending, and that was the sum of it. He was at this point going to a new technical school, learning to be a cook, taking public transport, and beginning to acquire some of the skills of independent life. But Sundays remained consecrated to drawing, and his work, commissioned and uncommissioned, multiplied each weekend. The question of Stephen's artistic talents often reminded me of Martin, a retarded musical and mnemonic savant whom I saw in the 1980s. Martin loved operas. His father had been a famous opera singer and could retain them after a single hearing. "I know more than 2,000 operas," he once told me. But his greatest passion was for Bach. And I thought it curious that this simple man should have such a passion. Bach seemed so intellectual, and Martin was a retardate. What I did not realize, until I started bringing in cassettes of the cantatas, of the Goldberg variations, and once of the Magnificat, was that, whatever his general intellectual limitations, Martin had a musical intelligence fully up to appreciating all the structural rules and complexities of Bach, all the intricacies of contrapuntal and fugal writing. He had the musical intelligence of a professional musician. I had never before properly recognized the cognitive structure of savant talents. I had, by and large, taken them to be an expression of rote memory and little else. Martin indeed had a prodigious memory, but it was clear that this memory, in relation to Bach, was structural or categorical, and specifically architectonic. He understood how the music went together, how this variation was an inversion of that, how different voices could take up a line and combine them in a canon or fugue, and he could construct a simple fugue himself. He knew for at least a few bars ahead how a line would go. He could not formulate this, it was not explicit or conscious, but there was a remarkable implicit understanding of musical form. Having seen this in Martin, I could now see analogues in the artistic, calendrical, and calculating savants I had also worked with. All of them had a genuine intelligence, but intelligence of a peculiar sort, confined to limited cognitive domains. Indeed, savants provide the strongest evidence that there can be many different forms of intelligence, all potentially independent of each other. The psychologist Howard Gardner expresses this in Frames of Mind. In the case of the idiot savant, we behold the unique sparing of one particular human ability against a background of mediocre or highly retarded human performances in other domains. The existence of these populations allows us to observe the human intelligence in relative, even splendid, isolation. Gardner postulates a multitude of separate and separable intelligences, visual, musical, lexical, etc., all of them autonomous and independent, with their own powers of apprehending regularities and structures in each cognitive domain, their own rules, and probably their own neural basis. In the early 1980s, this notion was put to the test by Beata Hermelin and her colleagues, exploring the powers of many different forms of savant talents. They found that visual savants were far more efficient than normal people at extracting the essential features from a scene or design, and at drawing these, and that their memory was not photographic or eidetic, but rather categorical and analytic, with the power to select and seize on significant features, using these to build their own images. It was also evident that once a structural formula had been extracted, it could be used to generate permutations and variations. Hermelin and her colleagues, along with Treffert, also worked with the blind, retarded, and enormously gifted musical prodigy Leslie Lemke, who, like blind Tom a century ago, is as renowned for his improvisational powers as for his incredible musical memory. Lemke catches the style of any composer from Bach to Bartók after a single hearing, and can thereafter play any piece or improvise effortlessly in that style. These studies seem to confirm that there were indeed a number of separate autonomous cognitive powers or intelligences, each with its own algorithms and rules, precisely as Gardner had hypothesized. There had been a certain tendency before this to see savant abilities as extraordinary, as freakish, but now they seem to be brought back into the realm of the normal, differing from ordinary abilities only by being isolated and heightened in degree. But do savant powers really resemble normal ones? One cannot have contact with a Stephen, a Nadia, a Martin, with any savant, without sensing something deeply other in action. It is not just that savant performances are off the scale, statistically or incredibly precocious in their first appearance. Martin could sing bits of operas before he was two, but that they seemed to deviate radically from normal developmental patterns. This was particularly clear with Nadia, who seemingly skipped the normal scribbling, schematic, and tadpole stages, and when she drew, did so in a way unlike any normal child. So it was with Stephen, who at seven, we know from Chris, did the most unchildlike drawings he had ever seen. The other side of the prodigiousness and precocity, the unchildlikeness of savant gifts, is that they do not seem to develop as normal talents do. They are fully fledged from the start. Stephen's art at seven was clearly prodigious, but at 19, though he may have developed a bit socially and personally, his talent itself had not developed too greatly. Savant talents in some ways resemble devices, ready-made, preset, and ready to go off. And this is how Gardner speaks of them. Assume that the human mind consists of a series of highly tuned computational devices, and that we differ vastly from one another in the extent to which each of these devices is primed to go off. Savant talents further have a more autonomous, even automatic quality than normal ones. They do not seem to occupy the mind or attention fully. Stephen will look around, listen to his Walkman, sing, or even talk while he is drawing. Jedediah Buxton's huge calculations moved ahead at their own fixed, imperturbable rate while he went on with his daily life. Savant talents do not seem to connect, as normal talents do, to the rest of the person. All this is strongly suggestive of a neural mechanism different from that which underlies normal talents. It may be that savants have a highly specialized, immensely developed system in the brain, a neuromodule, and that this is switched on at particular times, when the right stimulus, musical, visual, whatever, meets the system at the right time, and immediately starts to operate full blast. Thus, for the twin calendar savants, seeing an almanac at the age of six set off their extraordinary calendrical skill. They were able straight away to see large-scale structural regularities in the calendar, perhaps to extract unconscious rules and algorithms, to see how the correspondence of dates and days could be predicted which the rest of us, if we could do it all, could do only with consciously worked out algorithms and a great deal of time and practice. The converse of this sudden kindling or turning on is also seen on occasion in the sudden disappearance of savant talents. Whether in retarded or autistic savants, or normal individuals with savant capacities. Vladimir Nabokov possessed, in addition to his many other talents, a prodigious calculating gift. But this disappeared suddenly and completely, he wrote, following a high fever with delirium at the age of 7. Nabokov felt that the calculating gift, which came and went so mysteriously, had little to do with him and seemed to obey laws of its own. It was different in kind from the rest of his powers. Normal talents do not come and go in this way. They show development, persist, enlarge, take on a personal style as they establish connections, and embed themselves increasingly in the mind and personality. They lack the peculiar isolation, uninfluencibility, and automaticity of savant talents. But a mind is not just a collection of talents. One cannot maintain a purely composite or modular view of the mind, as many neurologists and psychologists now do. This removes that general quality of mind, call it reach or range or size or spaciousness, that is always instantly recognizable in normal people. It is a capacity that seems to be supramodal, and that shines through whatever particular talents there are. This is what we mean when we say that someone has a fine mind. A modular view of the mind, no less importantly, also removes the personal center, the self, the I. Normally, there is a cohering and unifying power. Coleridge calls it an esemplastic power that integrates all the separate faculties of mind, integrates them, too, with our experiences and emotions, so that they take on a uniquely personal cast. It is this global or integrating power that allows us to generalize and reflect, to develop subjectivity and a self-conscious self. Kurt Goldstein was especially interested in such a global capacity, which he referred to as the organism's abstract categorical capacity, or abstract attitude. Part of Goldstein's work was concerned with the effects of brain damage, and he found that whenever there was extensive damage, or damage involving the frontal lobes of the brain, there tended to be, over and above the impairments of specific abilities, linguistic, visual, whatever, an impairment of abstract categorical capacity, often as damaging as, sometimes far more damaging than, the specific impairments. Goldstein also explored various developmental problems, and, with his colleagues Martin Shearer and Eva Rothman, published the deepest study ever made of an idiot savant. Their subject, L, was a profoundly autistic boy with remarkable musical, mathematical, and memorial talents. In their 1945 paper, A Case of Idiot Savant, an experimental study of personality organization, they comment on the limitations of a multifactorial or composite theory of mind. If there exists only a composite of individual capabilities which are so independent from each other, L should have theoretically been able to become a proficient musician and mathematician. Since this contradicts the facts of the case, we have to explain why he did not, despite his interests and training. He did not, they conclude, because for all his impressive and real talents, there was something else, something global, irremediably missing. L suffers from an impairment of abstract attitude affecting his total behavior throughout. This expresses itself in the linguistic sphere by his inability to understand or to use language in its symbolic or conceptual meaning, to grasp or formulate properties of objects in the abstract, to raise the question why regarding real happenings, to deal with fictitious situations, to comprehend their rationale. The same impairment underlies his lack of social awareness and of curiosity in people, his limited values, his inability to register or absorb anything of the sociocultural and interhuman matrix around him. The same impairment to abstract is evidenced in his savant performance, which cannot be lifted out of its concrete context for reflection or verbalization. Owing to his impaired abstract attitude, L cannot develop his endowment actively and creatively. It remains abnormally concrete, specific, and sterile. It cannot become integrated with a broader meaning of the subject, nor with social insight. It approaches rather a caricature of a normal talent. If Goldstein's formulations about idiot savants and autism are generally valid, and if Stephen is indeed lacking or relatively lacking an abstract attitude, how much of an identity or a self might he be able to acquire? What power of reflective consciousness might be possible for him? To what extent can he learn or be influenced by personal or cultural contact? To what extent can he make such contact? How much can he develop a genuine sensibility or style? How much is any personal as opposed to technical development possible for him? What might be the resonances of all this for his art? These and many other questions, which one encounters with the paradox of an immense talent attached to a relatively rudimentary mind and identity, become sharper in the light of Goldstein's considerations. In October 1991, I met Stephen in San Francisco. I was struck by how much he had changed since I last saw him. Now 17, he was taller, handsomer, and his voice deeper. He was excited to be in San Francisco and kept describing the scenes he had seen on television of the 1989 earthquake, in short, haiku-like phrases. Bridges snapped, cars crushed, gas bursting, hydrants flowing, gaps opening, people flying. On the first day we climbed to the top of Pacific Heights, Stephen started drawing Broderick Street, which snakes up to the top of the hill. He looked around vaguely while he was drawing, but was mostly engrossed in listening to his Walkman. We had asked him earlier why Broderick snaked instead of going straight up. He could not say or see that it was because of its steepness, and when Margaret said steep to him, he just repeated it echolalically. He still seemed clearly retarded, or cognitively defective. As we walked, we came upon a sudden enchanting revelation of the bay, dotted with ships, and with Alcatraz set like a gem in the middle. But for a moment I did not see this. I did not see a scene at all. Just an intricate pattern of many colors. A highly abstract, uncategorized mass of sensations. Was this how Stephen saw it? Stephen's favorite building in San Francisco was the Transamerica Pyramid. When I asked him why, he said, "Its shape." And then, with an uncertain air, "It's a triangle, an isosceles triangle. I like that." I was struck by the fact that Stephen, with his often primitive language, should use the word isosceles. Though it is typical of autistic people, sometimes in early childhood, that they may acquire geometrical concepts and terms to a far greater degree than personal or social ones. He has very little explicit understanding of autism. This came out in an unlikely incident on Polk Street. We had, by a million to one chance, got behind a car with a license plate that spelled autism. I pointed it out to Stephen. "What does that say?" I asked. He spelled it out, laboriously. A-U-T-I-S-M-2. "Yes," I said, "and that reads..."
Utism,
he stuttered. "Almost, not quite. Not utism. Autism. What is autism?" "It's what's on that license plate," he answered, and I could get no further. Clearly, He recognizes that he is different, that he is special. He has a veritable passion for Rain Man, and one must suspect identifies with the Dustin Hoffman character, perhaps the only autistic hero ever widely portrayed. He has the entire soundtrack of the film on tape and plays it continually on his Walkman. Indeed, he can recite large portions of the dialogue, taking every part with perfect intonation. His preoccupation with the film and his constant playing of the cassette have not distracted him at all from his art. He can draw wonderfully even though his attention seems to be elsewhere. But it has made him far less accessible to conversation and social contact. Going along with Steven's obsession with Rain Man is his fervent desire to visit Las Vegas. He wanted, when he got there, to spend time in a casino, as Rain Man had, and not, in his usual way, to see the buildings in town. So he spent a single night there, and then, in a 1991 Lincoln Continental, set out across the desert for Arizona. He would have preferred a 1972 Chevrolet Impala, Margaret told me, but this, to Stephen's disappointment, was not available. We pulled up to a parking lot near the Grand Canyon. Part of the canyon was visible from here. But Stephen's attention was immediately distracted by the other cars in the lot. When I asked him what he thought of the canyon, he said, "It's very, very nice. A very nice scene. What does it remind you of?" "Like buildings. Architecture," Stephen answered. We found a spot for Stephen to draw the north rim of the canyon. He started to draw less fluently and assuredly, perhaps, than he would draw a building, but he seemed to extract the basic architecture of the rocks, nonetheless. "You're a genius, Stephen," Margaret remarked. Stephen nodded, smiled. "Yeah, yeah." Knowing Stephen's love of aerial views, we decided to fly over the Grand Canyon in a helicopter. Stephen was excited and kept craning his head in all directions as we flew low through the canyon, skimming the north rim, and then higher and higher to get a bird's-eye view of the whole. Our pilot kept talking about the geology and history of the canyon, but Stephen ignored him, and I think saw only shapes, lines, boundaries, shadows, shadings, colors, perspectives. And I, sitting next to him, following his gaze, started, I imagined, to see it through his eyes, relinquishing my own intellectual knowledge of the rock strata below, and seeing them in purely visual terms. Stephen had no scientific knowledge or interest, could not, I suspect, have grasped any of the concepts of geology, and yet such was the force of his perceptual power, his visual sympathy, that he would not be able to get and later draw the canyon's geological features with absolute precision and with a selectivity not to be obtained in any photograph. He would get the canyon's feel, its essence, as he had got the essence of the Matisse. We set out across the desert once again, and as we climbed toward Flagstaff, the saguaros grew rarer. The last one, a bold loner, stood out at 2,800 feet. The bleak Bradshaw Range, where silver and gold were found in the 80s, rose to our left. We entered a flat plain covered with prickly pear, with occasional cattle roaming. Horses and burros and occasionally pronghorn antelope still roam these plains. The San Francisco peaks floated high like vast ships on the horizon. "Very nice landscape to put motor cars into," Stephen remarked. He had earlier drawn a big green Buick against a backdrop of Monument Valley. I was amused and outraged. Faced with the sublimest, grandest vista on the planet, Stephen could only think to put motor cars into it. While I scribbled, Stephen drew cacti. He had seized on them as an emblem of the West, as he had seized on gondolas for Venice, skyscrapers for New York. An animal, probably a rabbit, darted across the road in front of us. Something got into me, and impulsively I cried, "Koipu!" Stephen was taken by the word, its acoustic contours, and repeated it with obvious pleasure a number of times. The Arizona trip showed us that Stephen could get desert, canyons, cacti, natural scenes in the same uncanny way as he could get buildings and cities. Most startling of all, perhaps, was an afternoon at the Canyon du Chelly, which Stephen descended with a Navajo artist, who showed him a special, sacred vantage point from which to draw and plied him with the myths and history of his people, how they had lived in the canyon centuries before. Stephen was indifferent to all this, but went ahead in his nonchalant way, looking around, muttering and humming to himself, while the Navajo artist sat, hardly moving, consecrated to the act of drawing. And yet, despite their so different attitudes, Stephen's drawing was manifestly the better, and seemed, even to the Navajo artist, to communicate the strange mystery and sacredness of the place. Stephen himself seems almost devoid of any spiritual feeling. Nonetheless, he had caught, with his infallible eye and hand, the physical expression of what we, the rest of us, call the sacred. Did Stephen somehow imbibe a sense of the sacred and project this into his drawing? Or do we, looking at his drawing, project this ourselves? There was often disagreement between Margaret and myself as to what Stephen actually felt, as with the wedding music at the monastery in Leningrad. But here, in the Canyon du Chelly, our roles were reversed. Margaret felt that Stephen had indeed been awed by the sacredness of the place, while I was skeptical. This deep uncertainty about what Stephen actually thinks and feels comes up constantly with everyone who knows him. I sometimes wondered whether emotion or emotional response might be radically different in Stephen, no less intense, but somehow more localized than the rest of us. Object-bound, scene-bound, event-bound, without ever coalescing or extending into anything more general, without becoming a part of him. I sometimes felt that he picked up the mood or the atmosphere of places, people, scenes, by a sort of instant sympathy or mimicry, rather than through what would usually be called a sensibility. Thus he might echo or reproduce or reflect the world's beauties, yet not have any aesthetic sense. He might resonate to the holy atmosphere in the Canyon du Chelly or in the monastery, and yet not have any religious sense of his own. Back in our hotel in Phoenix, I heard sounds of wind instruments coming from Stephen's room next door. I knocked at his door and entered. Stephen was alone, his hands cupped around his mouth. "What was that?" I asked. "A clarinet," he said, and then did a tuba, a saxophone, a trumpet, and a nose flute, all with uncanny accuracy. I returned to my room thinking about Stephen's disposition and power to reproduce, its many levels and how it dominated his life. As a child, he had shown echolalia when spoken to, echoing the last word or two of whatever other people said, and this still occurred, typically when he was tired or regressed. Echolalia carries no emotion, no intentionality, no tone whatever. It is purely automatic and may even occur during sleep. Stephen's koipu the day before was more complex than this, for he had savored the sound, the peculiar emphasis I gave it, but did it in his own way, an imitation with variations. Then, at a still higher level, there was his reproduction of Rain Man, in which he reproduced or represented entire characters, their interactions, conversations, and voices. He often seemed nourished and stimulated by these, but at other times taken over, possessed and dispossessed by them. Such a possession may occur at many levels, and may also be seen in people with post-encephalitic syndromes or Tourette syndrome. An automatic mimicry can occur in these, a reflection of a low-level physiological force overriding a normal mind and personality. Such a force may determine the more automatic aspects of autistic mimicry, too. But there may also be, at higher levels, a sort of identity hunger, a need to take off, take on, take in other personas, Mira Rothenberg has sometimes compared autistic people in this sense to sieves, constantly sucking in other identities, but unable to retain and assimilate them. Yet, she points out, after 35 years of experience, she still feels there is always a real self that she can connect to in the autistic. Our last morning in Phoenix, I was up at 7:30, watching the sunrise from my hotel room balcony. I heard a cheery hello, Oliver, and there was Stephen on an adjacent balcony. "Wonderful day," he said, and then, holding his yellow camera, snapped me as I smiled back from my balcony. This seemed such a friendly, personal act. It would stay in my mind as our farewell to Arizona. As we walked outside, he went over to the cacti. "Bye, saguaro. Bye, barrel. Bye, prickly pear. See you next time." The paradox of Stephen's art was sharpened for me, but without resolution, by this trip. Margaret was constantly delighted by his work and would hug him and say, "Stephen, you give such delight. You have no idea how much pleasure you give." Stephen would give his goofy smile and chortle, but Margaret was right. He did, through his drawings, bring others great pleasure. And yet it was not clear that they were associated in him with any emotion whatever, other than the pleasure of a faculty being exercised and used. At one point on our Arizona trip, stopping at a Dairy Queen, Stephen ogled two girls sitting at a table and was so fascinated by them, indeed, that he forgot to go to the restroom. In some ways, he is a normal adolescent boy. Neither his autism nor his savantism precludes this. Later, he went up to the girls. He is not unpersonable on first impression. But he spoke to them in a manner so inappropriate and childlike that they looked at each other, giggled, and then ignored him. Adolescence, both physical and psychological, perhaps slightly belated, now seems to be rushing ahead with great speed. Suddenly, Stephen has developed a strong interest in his appearance, his clothes, rock music, and girls. "He never seemed to notice mirrors when he was younger," Margaret said, "but now he is always checking himself, preening before them. He has developed very decided tastes in clothing. I like Western-style jeans, light blue, garment-washed, and shirts, and black Western boots." "What do you think of Oliver's shoes?" Margaret asked archly on one occasion. "Boring," he said, throwing a glance at them. Very little social life as yet is possible for Stephen. He meets people superficially, but does not know how to talk with them, and has few friends or real relationships outside his own family or the Hewsons. He is very close to his sister, Annette, and can be affectionate to her. He feels himself the man of the house, a protector of his mother, and he feels that Margaret is very much a protector of himself. But for the most part, he is thrown back on his drawings, and on increasingly charged and detailed daydreams. The world that really excites Stephen at this point is that of Beverly Hills 90210, a television show he adores. Last year, I asked him about it. "I love Jenny Garth," he said. "She's the coolest girl in L.A. She's got red lipstick. She's 21 years old. She's from Illinois. She's in Beverly Hills 90210. I fell in love with Jenny Garth. It started in 1991, I think. She plays Kelly Taylor. She always wears jeans and Western-style shirts and bodysuits." It is not just Jenny Garth, but the entire cast of the show that Stephen is in love with, and whom he now incorporates in more and more elaborate fantasies. "I collect their pictures," he said. "I sent them several drawings." Now he wants to design a penthouse for them on Park Avenue. They will all live together, and he will live with them as artist in residence. He will decide who may visit them and who may not. In the evening, after they have worked all day, they will all eat out together or have a picnic in the penthouse. He has drawings of all this. He has also been making fantasy sexy drawings of girls. Margaret discovered this by accident one day, while they were traveling, when she wandered into his hotel room and found a drawing by his bed. His other drawings, even the grandest ones, which he has spent days making, he is almost indifferent to. They can get lost or damaged, and he scarcely cares. But the sexy drawings are manifestly different. He seems to feel these as his own and keeps them in the privacy of his room. He would not think of showing them to anyone. They are wholly different from his other drawings, his commissioned work, for they are an expression of his inner life and dreams and needs, of his emotional and personal identity, whereas the architectural drawings, however dazzlingly accomplished, are not intended as anything more than likenesses, reproductions. Stephen's interest in girls, his fantasies of them, all seem very normal, very adolescent in a way, and yet they are marked by a childishness, a naivete that reflects his deep lack of human and social knowledge. It is difficult to imagine him dating, much less enjoying a deep personal or sexual relationship. These things, one suspects, may never be possible for him. I wonder whether he feels this or feels sad about it sometimes. In July of 1993, Margaret phoned me, beside herself with excitement. "Stephen's erupted musical powers," she announced. "Huge powers. You must come and see him straight away." I was startled by her call. I had never known her so excited. Stephen's musical talents clearly went back to early childhood, like his artistic talents. Lorraine Cole writes that even when he was scarcely verbal, he was a natural performer and mime. His portrayal of an angry man in a restaurant was so spirited and so funny that it was only when we played back the video we had made that we realized he had used no actual words, only a wide range of angry noises. It was then that we understood his capacity for imitating sounds. This was especially striking after a brief visit to Japan. The sound of the language fascinated him, and when Andrew picked him and Margaret up from Heathrow, Stephen babbled pseudo-Japanese complete with Japanese gestures to such effect that Andrew almost crashed the car laughing. It had been clear to all of us for years that Stephen had an immense ability to reproduce instrumental sounds, voices, accents, intonations, melodies, rhythms, arias, songs, complete with words or lyrics when need be. An effortlessly large and accurate auditory memory. And, significantly, he liked music, too. It moved him with an almost physical pleasure, almost more, I think, than drawing did. But Margaret, who knew all this better than I, was obviously referring to something more, to some quite new and unexpected breakthrough. The crucial factor, she had said, had been finding the right music teacher for Stephen. She's marvelous, darling. And they had struck up an instant rapport. I timed a visit to London to coincide with one of their weekly music lessons, and took along my niece, Liz Chase, a music teacher and pianist with a very acute ear, skilled in improvisation, analysis, and theory. Liz and I had been chatting with Evie Preston, his music teacher, for a few minutes, when Stephen came in gustily at the stroke of 12. "Hello, Evie, how are you? I am fine," he said. Then, "Hello, Oliver Sacks, how are you?" And when I introduced my niece, "Hello, Liz Chase, how are you?" He then rushed over to the piano, and under Evie's bidding, started to play scales, then to sing chords, starting with major triads. He did all this very easily and gleefully. The idea of thirds, fifths, this Pythagorean numerical sense of musical intervals, seemed quite innate in Stephen. "I never had to teach him," Evie remarked. He seemed hungry for more. "Let's do sevenths now," Evie said, and Stephen nodded and chortled, as if he had been promised a chocolate. Next, Evie said, "Now we'll do the blues." You take the top, I'll do the base. Using only three fingers, it looked ungainly but worked brilliantly, Stephen now improvised an upper voice full of intriguing, delightful complications. At first he confined his improvisations to the lower half of one octave, but then became bolder, his improvisations steadily becoming wider-ranging, more complex. He did six improvisations in all, rising to a climax in the last one. But Liz said, "Improvisation is easy. You do it off the top of your head." If one had the musical intelligence to catch the variational structure, she added, an ability to generate variations was almost automatic, a defining quality of intelligence itself. What she did find remarkable was how Stephen had infused his improvisations with feeling, with something of himself, how he had made them creative, daring, and dramatically interesting. Evie asked Stephen if he would sing "What a Wonderful World." His singing seemed to be full of genuine feeling, and his gestures, while he sang, were not his usual, stilted, tick-like ones. As soon as the song was over, Evie asked Stephen to analyze it harmonically, to sing and number all the chords. He did so without a moment's hesitation. It is clear that he is possessed of quite extraordinary powers of harmonic identification, analysis, and reproduction, Liz noted. Then Evie gave him an exercise in interpretation, as she does every week, playing a theme he had never heard before, Schumann's Traumerei. Stephen listened intently and told us his associations as he listened. "It's about air in the field, daffodils in springtime, a stream, sunshine, I love it, rose gardens, light breezes, fresh, children come out to play with their friends." Was Stephen, so lacking in feeling or cut off from it for the most part, actually feeling these affects and moods? Or had he learned, been taught somehow, to decode music, to learn that such and such forms were pastoral or vernal, and as such would have appropriate images? Was this a sort of trick, performed without any real feeling? I mentioned this thought to Evie later, and she told me that at first his associations to music were random or egocentric, strikingly irrelevant to the actual tone of the piece. She then explained what feelings or images went with different forms of music, and now he has learned these. But she thinks he also feels them. Finally, it was time for Stephen to choose a song he wanted to perform. He wanted to do "It's Not Unusual," a song much to his liking, a piece on which he could really let himself go. He sang with great enthusiasm, swinging his hips, dancing, gesticulating, miming, clutching an imaginary microphone to his mouth, addressing himself in imagination to a vast arena. "It's Not Unusual" has become the theme song of Tom Jones, and in his version, Stephen took on Jones's flamboyant physicality, adding to it a flavor of Stevie Wonder. He seemed completely at one with the music, completely possessed, and at this point there was none of the skewed neck posture that is habitual with him, none of the stiltedness, the ticking, the aversion of gaze. His entire autistic persona, it seemed, had totally vanished, replaced by movements that were free, graceful, with emotional appropriateness and range. Very startled at this transformation, I wrote in large capitals in my notebook, "Autism disappears." But as soon as the music stopped, Stephen looked autistic once again. Until now, it had seemed to be part of Stephen's nature, part of being autistic, to be defective, precisely in that range of emotions and states of mind that defines a self for the rest of us. And yet in the music he seemed to have been given these, to have borrowed an identity, though these were lost the moment the music ended. It was as if, for a brief time, he had become truly alive. Stephen's music lesson then was a revelation to me, not just of further talents, not wholly unexpected in an autistic savant, but of a mode of being that I would not have thought available to him. Nothing of what I had seen with him before, and nothing in his art, had quite prepared me for this. He seemed to be using his whole self, his whole body, with all its repertoire of movements and expressions, to sing, to enact the song. Though it remained unclear to me whether this was basically a brilliant piece of pantomime, or a true entering into the words, the feelings, the inner states of the song. It raised for me, even more acutely than some of his Matisse drawings, the question of whether he treated the originals, paintings or songs, as representations of inwardness, of others' states of mind, or as objects. Did he, so to speak, enter the painter's or the songwriter's head, share their subjectivity, or merely treat their productions, like houses, as purely physical, as objects? Was his repetition of Rain Man, for that matter, just a literal playback, a mimicry or echolalia, or was it charged with a sense of the significance of the film? Were his gifts no more than mindless, amant talents, in Goldstein's term, or were they genuine achievements of mind and identity? Goldstein is quick to equate mind with the abstract categorical, the conceptual, and to regard anything else as pathological, as sterile. But there are forms of health, of mind, other than the conceptual, although neurologists and psychologists rarely give these their due. There is mimesis, itself a power of mind, a way of representing reality with one's body and senses, a uniquely human capacity no less important than symbol or language. Merlin Donald, in Origins of the Modern Mind, has speculated that mimetic powers of modeling, of inner representation, of a wholly nonverbal and non-conceptual type, may have been the dominant mode of cognition for a million years or more in our immediate predecessor, Homo erectus, before the advent of abstract thought and language in Homo sapiens. As I watched Stephen sing and mime, I wondered if one might not understand at least some aspects of autism and savantism in terms of the normal development, even hypertrophy of mimesis-based brain systems, this ancient mode of cognition coupled with a relative failure in the development of more modern symbol-based ones. And yet, even if some analogies can be drawn here, they are very partial and must not mislead us. Stephen is neither an amant, nor a computer, nor a Homo erectus. All our models, all our terms, break down before him. Stephen's development has been singular, qualitatively different from the start. He constructs the universe in a different way, and his mode of cognition, his identity, his artistic gifts go together. We do not know finally how Stephen thinks, how he constructs the world, how he is able to draw and sing. But we do know that though he may be lacking in the symbolic, the abstract, he has a sort of genius for concrete or mimetic representations. Whether drawing a cathedral, a canyon, a flower, or enacting a scene, a drama, a song, a sort of genius for catching the formal features, the structural logic, the style, the thisness, though not necessarily the meaning of whatever he portrays. Creativity, as usually understood, entails not only a what, a talent, but a who, strong personal characteristics, a strong identity, personal sensibility, a personal style, which flow into the talent, interfuse it, give it personal body and form. Creativity in this sense involves the power to originate, to break away from the existing ways of looking at things, to move freely in the realm of the imagination, to create and recreate worlds fully in one's mind, while supervising all this with a critical inner eye. Creativity has to do with inner life, with the flow of new ideas and strong feelings. Creativity in this sense will probably never be possible for Stephen. But the catching of thisness, perceptual genius, is no small gift. It is quite as rare and precious as more intellectual gifts. I once referred to Jose as living not in a universe, but in what William James called a multiverse of innumerable, unconnected, though intensely vivid particulars, and as experiencing the world, in Proust's term, as a collection of moments, vivid, isolated, with no before or after. I imagined Jose, who liked to draw animals and plants, as an illustrator for botanical works or herbals. Indeed, I have since heard that an autistic artist is employed by the Royal Botanical Gardens at Kew. Is autism necessary to, or an ingredient of his art? Most autists are not artists, as most artists are not autists. But in the chance of their coming together, as in Stephen or Jose, there must, I think, be an interaction between the two, so that the art takes on some of the strengths and weaknesses of autism, its remarkable capacity for minutely detailed reproduction and representation, but also its repetitiveness and stereotypy. But whether one can speak of a distinctive autistic art, I am not sure. Is Stephen or his autism changed by his art? Here I think the answer is no. I do not have the feeling that his art spreads or diffuses in any sense into his character, or alters the general tone of his mind. But this, perhaps, is not entirely surprising. There are many examples of artists who are great, even sublime in their art, but whose personal lives are unremarkable, incoherent, or vile. There are others, of course, whose lives match their art. Of those with classical autism, 50% are mute, never use speech. 95% lead very limited lives. Stephen, in a sense, has escaped from these statistics, in part through his art, in part by virtue of those who have stood so committedly behind him. Gifts and art, unrecognized, unsupported, are not enough. Jose is almost as gifted as Stephen, but has never been recognized, never supported, and continues to languish on a back ward. Whereas Stephen lives a varied and stimulating life. He travels, goes out drawing, and now attends art school. Margaret Hewson, Chris Maris, and others have played an essential part in supporting him and nurturing his gifts, making possible for him his present creative life. But his passivity remains extreme. And he will continue, I think, to need such personal support, as blind Tom needed the support of Colonel Bethune. Stephen's drawings may never develop, may never add up to a major opus, an expression of a deep feeling or theory or a view of the world. And he may never develop, or enter the full estate, the grandeur and misery of being human, of man. But this is not to diminish him, or to call his gift small. His limitations, paradoxically, can serve as strengths, too. His vision is valuable, it seems to me, precisely because it conveys a